There is a stretch of trees on the border between Bath and Wiltshire, which has been left mostly undisturbed for centuries. This section of forest is commonly known as Sally in the Wood. The name, it is generally agreed, comes from a girl they call Sally, who lives, or rather, to be precise, does not live, but in some form resides upon that lonely strip of road.
Hello, I'm Tamsin Wheatley and you're listening to Folklore. If you're listening to me for the first time, I'd really recommend going back and listening to our previous episodes for some context. As for those of you who are with me last week, you'll probably be feeling as disillusioned as I am. I found that having an incomplete mystery was worse than no mystery, and as much as I loved Neil, his notes on the barber surgeon case, if you can even call it a case, were frustrating. You'll understand that I was glad when I began to prepare for this week's investigation to find that Neil had been more meticulous with his tapes this time. Or rather, I was glad. But things this week have gotten a little strange. Yes, I know I say that every week, but this time I promise it's true. I've not been sleeping well recently, which probably doesn't help. These connections between the Keelers, Goddards and the rest, if indeed there are any genuine connections, have been occupying a lot of my thoughts. There's also the incidents involving my garden, but frankly I'd rather not talk more about those unless I have to. Before we begin, I should say this case has a darker air to it than many of the others we've looked at, which is why right at the top of this episode I want to put a content warning, so you know what you're getting into. In today's episode, there will be discussion of schizoaffective disorder, violence against women, and mentions of rape, murder, torture, and suicide. There's also another thing, a stranger thing, which feels like it deserves a warning, but I'm not quite sure how to phrase it. In order to warn you about it, I should probably explain. When I was going through the tapes prior to working on this episode, I found something odd. Neil had left behind two tapes, both labelled Sally in the Wood and dated the same day. One contained an interview with a young woman, which we're going to hear next. The other I'm going to refer to as the second tape, and I don't think it's for the faint of heart. Maybe don't listen to this episode too late at night. Personally, I'm still not sure what to make of it, except for the fact that it has definitely exacerbated my growing unease. Anyway, on with the show.
This is Henry Neil. It is the 29th of April, 1980, and the time is currently 3:17 in the PM. I'm here with a young woman who has had an experience in the Sally in the Wood area. Could you say your name for me, please?
Dunning. Lydia Dunning?
Thank you. So, Miss Dunning?
Mrs, actually. Sorry.
Oh, no, not at all. Mrs Dunning. Sorry, you're quite young.
Oh, we got married 3 months ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
So, Mrs Dunning, could you talk to me about what happened?
How do you mean?
Just start at the beginning and we'll go through to the end. Hopefully that'll help us pull on this thread a little.
Okay, sure. So, I'm driving back home to my home in Wiltshire. I work in Bath, so... Yeah, I work in Bath. I'm driving home. I had to stay late that night and I'm driving and I come to the A363... the stretch which passes through Sally in the Wood.
And what happened on that stretch of road?
This isn't a ghost story, Mr. Neil. I don't believe in ghosts, so I don't know what happened. Not exactly, but I know it wasn't anything supernatural. It wasn't Sally.
Noted, Mrs. Dunning.
So, I'm in my car, and I'm driving down that stretch of road. I have both hands on the wheel, and suddenly I hear this noise, like music. Only, if you ever used a tuning fork, Mr. Neil?
Yes.
Well, You know when you hold it against your ear and the sound reverberates inside of you? So I'm hearing music, but it's not so much that I'm hearing it as it is that the music is carving these little holes into my skin, drilling into the back of my skull. I feel my bones vibrate from the impact of it, and I lose control. But I'm a good driver. I regain. I stop. Sit there, shaking. Then there's this incredibly bright light, and I think someone's coming down the road with their high beams on. But then it vanishes, and there's no car. I can't see any car anywhere, and I'm alone. I start to hear this tapping, so gentle. Little knocks on the roof of my car. Were you in the scouts, Mr. Neil?
No.
I was in the Girl Guides. We learned Morse code. So there's this knocking on the roof, and then this hand comes down. It's not particularly scary. It's just a hand attached to an arm, and she crawls, the girl, the thing, crawls down from the roof of the car onto the bonnet of the car, and she's sat there, but she's not looking at me. I haven't seen her face, not yet, so she's looking out at the forest, back and forth, almost like she's scared, really. And then I feel a hand, another hand, on the back of my neck, and it's soft and squishy, like wax, like slightly warm wax. Not liquid melted wax, but wax which has been slightly warmed. Just enough that it's malleable, like wet clay. So there's this hand, and it's holding my neck right at the spot where I had felt the music enter my body. And the grasp is so gentle and almost pathetic. It's pouring at me like a kitten, but it gets stronger. The longer I sit there, and the girl on the bonnet suddenly turns around, and I see her face. Have you ever seen coral, Mr. Neil? Her face was like a sort of human coral, a fleshy coral. She shrieks. But no shrieking sound comes out. It's more like a xylophone made of prisms, maybe. And that sound hits me and I blink because it's like somebody has just shone a torch into my eyes. And then the light clears and I'm sat in my car. And that's it. That's the end. I drive home. Yeah.
That's quite a story.
Not really. There's no evidence, you know, no scratches on the bonnet, no wax on the back seat, just me.
But you're a pretty respectable witness, right? You understand that. I mean, I'd be more inclined to believe you than some other people.
Well, you shouldn't. I'm no more trustworthy than anyone else.
Well, is it true, then, this story?
I believe that I saw all those things.
You don't sound very sure.
My grandmother took her own life, Mr. Neil. She had delusions, but everyone else, including her husband, thought she was just lying and wanted attention. Nobody believed her. Nobody ever believed her. She was crying out for help, and nobody listened. It's genetic, you know, the disorder. So, no, I don't think I'm a reliable witness.
I'm sorry.
There is a mystery here, Mr. Neil, and there is a horror, but that mystery is the mystery of the human mind. The horror, the white-knuckle terror I feel every day isn't because I'm scared of a ghost. I'm scared of my genes, of my grandmother screaming while nobody listens. So yeah, I'm terrified. I look at my husband, but I'm not scared of a forest or of Sally. I'm scared of me.
It seems clear to me that Neil, while at first intrigued, dismissed this story sometime between his recording of it and his recording later that day of the second tape. I'm not so sure, however. Lydia recalls the events with remarkable clarity, and they are, to be frank, so bizarre that it seems unlikely she would invent them deliberately. As to what I think of the conversation about delusions, well, let me play you this audio I recorded during a chat with Anna Dunning, Lydia's daughter. Lydia passed away a few years ago now, but Anna very kindly agreed to have a Zoom call with me to talk about the tape of her mother. I played it for her first, and then asked her thoughts.
That's fascinating. That's really, really interesting.
I'm glad it was a good experience to listen to it. I'm aware it could have been quite an upsetting listen.
Yeah, yes, definitely, but so, so interesting.
What do you find interesting about it?
Two things. Firstly, my mother never had schizoaffective disorder, delusions.
Oh, okay, and you're sure?
Very, very sure, because I do. I was diagnosed as a teenager. It's something I've struggled with all my life. I've become very good at recognising it in others. Visual delusions, incidentally, isn't very few people start with visual delusions. It's almost always auditory, hearing voice, which can be harmless up to a point. And then if that intensifies, either due to a lack of treatment or overzealous treatment, then it may progress to a point of visual delusions. But starting with a visual delusion that intense, that's unusual. I'd actually say that's not impossible, but super unlikely.
Okay, wow, that puts a new spin on things.
Yeah. Also, she's right, the disorder is genetic or has a genetic component, but when we talked about this, she only ever talked about her grandmother, my great-grandmother, and her struggles, and she never even suggested that she might also have had it, which makes me think it never came back. Certainly, I had always assumed that it had skipped a generation, a few generations actually, between my great-grandmother and myself, and that neither my mother or grandfather had suffered from it.
So, obviously that's really compelling and raises a lot of questions. What was the other thing you were going to tell me about?
Well, the second thing is that my mother never told me this story. But she did tell me about another story. In fact, it became an oft-told tale in my house, which is that I was born in Sally in the Wood.
No way.
Yeah. So there were complications when I was born, and my mother had to be redirected in the ambulance to the RUH in Bath. And that took them right through Sally in the Wood, and I was born in the woods, which is a really odd coincidence. Also interesting, potentially, is that my great-grandmother, who sadly died by suicide, she lived in a cottage not far from Brown's Folly, which is the area surrounding the A363. I don't know why my mother didn't mention that. That feels like a weird thing not to bring up. Maybe she didn't think it was relevant. Maybe she forgot. Maybe she didn't know at the time or hadn't quite realised just how close my great-grandmother's house was to the woods. Yeah. So those things all feel really weird. Listening to that story and the fact she never mentioned it to me, even after I'd been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, that feels strange. And I can't explain that part of her behaviour, unless towards the end of her life she stopped believing that what she witnessed was a product of mental illness and started believing there was another cause. I'm not saying a supernatural cause necessarily. My mother was very religious, so that may have been a part of it. I don't know. I don't have any answers for you, but I really want to thank you for providing me with this, because it's wonderful to hear her voice again, basically. Even if she is describing some just like absolutely nightmarish scenes, it's great to hear her voice. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You'll understand I was feeling confused and spooked in equal measure here. I've always tried to keep an analytical mind throughout my investigations, but something about the atmosphere of this story made it feel different. Combining that with the news that Mrs. Dunning hadn't, in fact, experienced schizoaffective disorder, at least as far as her daughter knew, I was struggling to come up with a rational explanation for the events she claimed to have witnessed. I decided I needed to know more about the history around both the case and the woods, especially as some people claimed it was one of the most haunted places in the world. But I had struggled to find any hard facts of what terrible things might have gone on there to give it such a sinister history. I felt like I needed to ground myself in the reality of the area, especially after listening to the second tape. So I contacted Dr. Matthew Reeves, PhD, an historian, folklorist, and political economist who I spoke to 2 weeks ago in the last episode. My conversation with him was fascinating and ranged from discussion of the rise of slasher movies in the 80s to the economics of the Great Witch Trials. For the purposes of time, I've edited it down to what you're about to hear, which are the most relevant sections. But I will upload the full interview to Patreon soon for those of you interested in the nitty-gritty details.
Hello, is this thing working?
Yes, you're fine, I can hear you.
Good, wonderful. It's nice to hear from you again, Miss Wheatley. I was surprised to get your email.
It was really nice of you to agree to do this.
I could hardly turn down Sally the Woodnut, could I? Even if it isn't my area of expertise exactly. But it's a hell of a story, this one.
Is there any idea about how that story got started?
Well, there's a lot of questions about the origins of the ghost and the myth of the ghost. Or the folklore of the ghost, perhaps, I should say. There's your title drop. There's your saying the name of the show in the show. You can put that in the opening credits. What was I talking about?
Sally.
Sally, yes, that's right. I once had someone tell me there was an insane asylum in the woods, which is ludicrous. But it's an example of how a folklore, is a living thing which evolves in response to movies, or what's considered scary at any given time, right? So, some people say the reason the area of Sully in the Wood got its name is from a Civil War skirmish which took place in the area. The name would come from the verb to sally, as in to sally forth, etc. That story has always felt like nonsense to me. Maybe that's because I'm not a Civil War specialist.
So, just for clarity, Sally in the Wood
is both the name of the ghost, quote-unquote, and the name of the location the ghost haunts. Yeah. Which is pretty unusual. And there is a school of thought which says that the area was named Sally in the Wood, and people thought that name was spooky as anything. And so naturally, a ghost story evolved from the name, rather than what most people assume is true, which is that the name evolved from the ghost story.
Okay, but you don't think that?
No.
So, what do you think?
Here's the really interesting thing about Sally. You go around the surrounding area and ask people about it, and pretty much everybody will say it's haunted, and pretty much nobody will say anything else. People just know it's a terrible place, that bad things happen there. But nobody has context. Nobody remembers any context. Doesn't that seem strange to you?
Not necessarily. It just means that people think it's a spooky place, but there's not necessarily any actual story, folklore, associated with it.
But you don't find it odd that a place could generate so much fear in so many people, without anybody being able to tell you what they're afraid of, about what they're scared. Nobody knows. Nobody remembers what it is that's meant to be so terrifying about Sally in the Wood, but the fear. The fear has endured even after the story. Stories have mostly died out. The stories which remain are inconsistent and incomplete. There have been 7 unexplained fatal car crashes on that little stretch of road, a fact which gets repeated constantly, but with no attribution of why a ghost would cause a car crash. The birds haven't sung in those woods for hundreds of years, but why not? Everybody knows the symptoms, but nobody's willing to diagnose the disease. Is it a demon? A ghost? Whose ghost? What kind of demon? None of it holds to any sort of logical consistency. Sally not only defies the usual rules of folklore, she simply doesn't even acknowledge they exist. Her myth is totally unique in that way.
So what do we know then?
Well, the truth is, as far as I can tell, that people have always felt there was just something wrong about that stretch of what is now the A363 just by Brown's Folly, long before it was given the moniker of Sally in the Wood. Now, like I said, most people don't remember how Sally came to be, but the stories which have survived are all about either the witch or the girl.
The witch or the girl?
Once upon a time, there was a young Romany girl. She wandered off from her family and went for a walk in the forest. There she was murdered. By who isn't specified in any version of the tale I found, but probably some local boys. She's either killed and buried in the forest, or, and I suspect this is a significantly later addition, imprisoned in Brown's Folly, where she's tortured, raped, and then killed.
So it's like a sort of ghostly version of Rapunzel meets Saw. Pleasant.
The Witcher story is simpler in a lot of ways. We know, or we think we know, that a real woman named Sarah Gibson lived there in the middle part of the 18th century. She'd been evicted from her house by the Lord of Warley Manor, a house which has its own dark history, but, as I say, a story for another time. She was evicted after her husband, who was a gamekeeper, died. She set up in a little cottage in the forest, and predictably people started calling her a witch, which was just this side of still being a good way to get someone hanged. She wasn't, though, but the rumours persisted. Child murder, blood rituals, all the usual nonsense. After she died, they burned down her cottage, probably to reclaim the land, but the locals, especially the local children, took it as a sign that they'd found something terrible in there. Absurd, obviously, but you have to understand the era we're talking about.
So those are the two stories?
Yes. And you want to know something? I don't believe either of them are the origin of the Sally myth.
So you believe it's all fiction?
I didn't say that. I think something about that place, a forgotten tale, a collective memory, or even just an atmosphere, is deeply sinister. How else could it draw so many ghost stories to it, like flies to honey? Or like flies sticking with submissive blood and marmalade, drunken flies that buzz over the tombs of the people.
Marmalade? Why do you mention marmalade?
Oh, it's a poem. One of my favourites, actually. Pablo Neruda, the United Fruit Company. Why is marmalade important?
I'll be honest, this whole thing was freaking me out. I felt closer to Neil than ever, but suddenly that didn't feel like such a good thing at all. Now I had a very in-depth knowledge of the folklore surrounding Brown's Folly, and the various stories about Sally. Those of you who have tuned in before are probably expecting me to go and check out the area in question now, like I have in previous episodes. But this time I don't feel comfortable doing that. To explain why, let me play you these extracts of the second tape that Neil recorded. Once again, for time purposes, I'm not going to play the whole thing. The full tape is long, even by Neil's standards. If you want to hear it all, I'm hoping to upload it to Patreon sometime soon, but the following sections should give you a sense of what the tape is like. Just to explain, the static screeching noises you'll be hearing, that's not me adding that.
This is Henry Neil. It's the 29th of April 1980, just approaching 10 o'clock, and it's pretty dark now. Whether that's because the sun is already fully down or just because of the woods, I'm not sure. I'll wait in my car for a couple of hours, then I'll go for a walk around midnight. So, something slightly spooky just happened. I'm pretty sure I saw a shape moving through the forest. Just a little way down from the road, I couldn't be sure, but it looked human. But is this just what I'm expecting to see? Seeing any movement at all in this section of the forest might make my brain start jumping to conclusions. It could well have been a deer. Henry Neil, I'm just turning this on because, well, this is silly, I think. But I just noticed mud on my shoe. And I haven't gone out of the car. It's still wet, so how can I have wet mud on my shoe when I haven't gotten out of the car?
Thank you. thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
But Jack Parsons took the Black Pilgrimage. I mean, I wonder how many others. Do you think our archaeologist friend did too? Do you think he wandered through Cyclopean streets of black pumice stone and obsidian malachite and saw what? What do you see at the end of the world, friend? What did you see there, Alexander? She has so many beautiful eyes. Every one a diamond.
A diamond!
The woods are lovely, dark and deep, and so forth. I can't see the moon. Must be cloudy. Hello? What's this? Footprints? There's a set of footprints leading me away from my car deeper into the woods. But like I've gotten out of the car and walked into the woods. But I haven't. I mean, there's something being disassembled, like broken down to its usable component parts. Yes, yes. I think it was a badger once. The bones are being carved into shape.
Being carved, being into carved, shape, being carved.
People say that ghosts get trapped in ley lines, trapped in perpetual loop like the needle on the grooves of a gramophone. I thought, if I'm going to see Sally anywhere, I need to find a line. Imagine if a place had enough darkness, enough gravity to its tragedy that it could tear reality apart. Sorry, I must have drifted off. What was I talking about again? Why is there mud on my shoe?
You can probably understand how upsetting I found listening to this tape. During all the time I knew Neil, I believed he was a stern believer in science. He never indicated any support for, or belief in, the supernatural, least of all ghosts. But this audio, quite apart from its chaotic and jumbled nature, the genuine fear in his voice is disturbing. And the things he's saying are far from typical Professor Neil. To be frank, the first time I listened to this, I found myself shaking. I don't know what Neil experienced in that forest, but here's somebody who might. Professor Neil, again.
Henry Neil, it's... doesn't matter. I've been thinking about what happened the other night. I say thinking. Drinking and thinking. I listened back to the tapes, all of them. It's funny. When I got home, I felt oddly well rested. I didn't remember anything, really. And then I put them on. A lot of my memories are still blurry, but some of it... I mean, there must be a rational explanation, to which I don't have. I just don't know what the rational scientific explanation is. But I have faith that there is one. I have faith in the fact that just because something hasn't been explained doesn't mean it can't be. There are no unknowable things. There are only things that we are yet to possess the means to uncover. Maybe one day this mystery will be solved. I have faith that one day this mystery will be solved. But not by me. No more pulling on this thread, eh, Henry? That's quite enough for now.
Listening to this tape of Neil, more vulnerable than I've ever known him to be, and drinking, something I didn't think he did, was uncomfortable, and I spent a long time debating about whether or not to even include this tape in the episode. But I didn't think it would be fair to show one side of him and not the other. I don't know if what Neil experienced in the woods was some kind of psychological break, or if he'd somehow come into contact with a psychoactive substance. But I find his faith in a rational solution, strangely calming. It's good to know he remains a fixed point in an ever-changing world. I don't think he fully persuaded himself, however, and to be honest, I don't think he's persuaded me. Which is why I am not, under any circumstances, doing any on-the-ground reporting from Sally in the Wood. And no, there will not be a Patreon bonus goal for me to go there before anyone makes that joke. I'm serious. The nature of this show means I rarely get any clear or definitive answers, but this one's left me feeling incredibly uncertain. Neil's bizarre and upsetting recordings from the woods have certainly made an impact. Before now, I think I've always, at least subconsciously, assumed that whatever I was investigating was false, that there's no such thing as ghosts. But given Neil's encounter, I'm finding small points of doubt spreading across the canvas of my mind. I looked into the Pablo Neruda poem Reeves mentioned, which included the reference to marmalade, but it doesn't seem to have any relevance to Neil at all. I'm starting to wonder if the toll these things have been taking on my mental health is worth it. My anxiety has been getting worse, but I feel like now I've started, I have to finish. I've always been stubborn like that. I keep feeling like I'm being watched, and while I have no evidence, I've bought an extra chain to go on my door anyway. There's another reason I found myself feeling unsettled. Earlier this week, the station I broadcast from received a letter addressed to me. I've got it here in my hand. Written on it in large blocky capitals are the words, "Stop following the tapes," which, as you can imagine, has only strengthened my resolve. I may be bending a little, but I'm not breaking yet. Thank you for exploring this mystery with me, Tamsin Wheatley. You've been listening to Folklore. To get in touch and share your thoughts, please search at folklore_pod on Twitter or find our official Facebook page. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share and subscribe, and give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you found us to help us reach even more listeners. You can also join in the discussion over on our official Folklore Facebook group. Or you can support the show and help make magic happen over on Patreon. And in exchange, you'll get access to all kinds of exclusive content, including some behind-the-scenes snippets, bonus stories, and extra interviews. Join me again in 2 weeks, when I'll be at Oddstock Church investigating the centuries-old tale of a hanged man, a cursed door, and superstition so strong that it gripped even the Bishop of Salisbury himself. Path down to the Shire of old, where the black shook cows as the magic takes hold. We've been spelling to the land.